I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is Neat.
I tried out a new one.
Okay.
Do you want to try a different one?
No, I like that. That was
you
good.
You liked it? Weird. Keep it. Oh, no. It. Oh, right. Man. It was a bold choice. I don't know. I regret it a little bit.
It's good. I think you should stand by it. It's a weekly boost cast, I believe?
It is. It's a history lesson with a twist.
Oh.
And the twist is referring to this lime in this margarita right here.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a whole wedge, though. It's not just a twist.
It's not a twist. It's much more than a twist. But, you know, if you get real twisty with it, you end up with a little bit more lime.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it... Yeah.
The twist got out of control.
Like a history lesson with a big ol' hunk of...
big ol' hunk of citrus.
Doesn't really work. But I
history
get it.
History lesson with a grapefruit.
Hello, I'm the grapefruit.
Does that make me the history lesson? Because I don't know if that works.
I just pictured like it's a history podcast, but then there's just a grapefruit that makes commentary.
Is the grapefruit like our mascot?
Come in from the position of a small grapefruit.
What is your opinion on this grapefruit?
I do not agree with the use of this cocktail in modern culture. From a grapefruit's opinion.
I find this grapefruit quite tart.
It's in my nature.
A little dry and bitter.
Okay, grapefruit, I'm sorry. You don't make the cut. This is a two-person podcast.
Yeah,
okay.
we don't have time for...
Goodbye.
Three, bye.
I'll see you in the morning with some cottage cheese.
Oh, are we going to eat you? That's horrifying.
That's what I'm for. I understand my fate.
A grapefruit with a manifest destiny?
I was born for one thing, to die!
In a really morbid way, too.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know.
Yeah, you cut it in half, and then you cut it into tiny sections, and then you scoop it out.
Isn't that really just what happens to all of us?
Oh, damn, that got dark.
I don't think that actually applies. I can't even figure it out. Hey, we were talking about margaritas,
margaritas, which traditionally don't have any grapefruit in them.
No.
Nope.
All right. But yeah, so we're gonna talk about some margarita history today. So the margarita is one of those cocktails that has a confusing origin story, like most cocktails.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
This one's not simple?
No, it's not simple.
Aw, man.
I will say this. Before I get into any claims to the margarita, I am going to apply some basic logic to where this cocktail might have come from.
Okay.
Because here's the thing. So your earliest claim to something looking like a margarita starts in like the late 1930s. When you hear the name margarita, it's more like the 40s. But the important thing to know is that margarita is Spanish for daisy.
Oh, and daisy is a thing, right?
Daisy is a thing. Daisy is a cocktail like long before this. In 1876, it's the first time you kind of see the term daisy in publication. What a daisy generally is thought of, like in modern terms, is some sort of base spirit, usually like 2 ounces, like a heavy pour, some sort of citrus, usually lime or lemon, like 3/4 ounces to an ounce, and then some sort of liqueur as a sweetener, also the same, like 3/4 to 1 ounce. So the idea of a daisy is around in the late 1800s. And actually the earliest publication is from Jerry Thomas, who's like one of the godfathers of cocktailing, somebody who started documenting before anybody else really was. You can kind of trust what he was putting down.
Okay.
So the only reason I bring this up is because, hey, the word daisy translate or is margarita in Spanish, the exact same structure, because a margarita is, a base spirit just happens to be tequila, 2 ounces, a citrus just happens to be lime, and a modifier, which just happens to be triple sec or Cointreau or whatever, orange liqueur. So exact same proportions, exact same name, just translated.
So it's just like their whoever's version of a daisy.
That's, I think anyone that kind of looks at it agrees that, because here's the thing, like, you've got, in 1920s is prohibition, where a lot of people, as we've talked about, start drinking in other places to get out of America and find booze. Right. And one of the places they go is to Mexico.
Sounds good. Let's go.
Yeah. And at that time, the Daisy was a popular drink. And it wasn't just like Jerry Thomas writes about the Brandy Daisy, which assumes brandy, but there's also the Gin Daisy, which is in like the Oxford English Dictionary in 1887. So this was a well-known build. Like, and that kind of takes it away from, was it a cocktail or was it just a recipe idea? Like, was it a build? And by then I think it was even established as just as much when I say a sour, like, modern bartenders would understand that a sour doesn't tell you what the base spirit is, what the citrus is, even what the sweetener is. It just implies there's some sort of base spirit, there's some sort of citrus, and there's some sort of sweetener.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's like a formula.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was already kind of a formula before then. So then, like, you hit prohibition, people are going to Mexico, they're ordering their drinks, and the likelihood that Mexican bartenders were kind of being like, well, we don't have brandy, maybe they didn't have gin, but they did have tequila, and they were working with the citruses and the spirits they had to reimagine this popular cocktail called a Daisy and translated the name. I think that makes sense.
Yeah, that checks.
Yeah. And you have like the earliest recognitions of something like this cocktail are like, you know, as early as like 1936, there's a newspaper editor from Iowa who spent some time in Tijuana, and he had a cocktail that was told to him that it was a Mexican substitute for a Daisy. And you have like a newspaper from Syracuse in like 1936, kind of the same thing. They called it a tequila Daisy, and they talked about experiencing it in Mexico. So once again, like, still kind of backs up, like, it was just the Mexican version of a Daisy.
Okay.
But that doesn't stop a bunch of people from making up these crazy stories about why it's theirs.
Are they good?
they're pretty goofy.
I want to hear some.
So, like, the first, one of the names that gets thrown down around a lot is Carlos Danny Herrera. Now, he had a restaurant in Tijuana, Rancho La Gloria, around 1938, and he said he made this drink because there was this beautiful aspiring actress, Marjorie King. She was a Ziegfeld dancer, and she was allergic to every spirit but tequila. If this is true, it's supposedly his story is like he knew like tequila shots were popular at that time, like salt and lime and tequila, so he just kind of added some orange liqueur to level it out, and that like this was the first time he made it. He made it on the fly for her. Why he called it the margarita?
Because her name was
Marjorie.
Marjorie.
Marjorie. Yeah. So kind of reads.
Maybe he was like trying to be slick, and he was like, maybe.
I would believe he already knew the cocktail, but maybe he presented it to her as the first time he made it.
Yeah. Maybe he was trying to get fresh.
I mean, you know, young.
It's a tale as old as time,
guess
really.
So. all right, but then that was 1938. So then in 1941, we have Don Carlos Orozco, who claims to have made it first time for the daughter of a visiting German ambassador. So we're dealing with like war times now.
Okay.
And this German ambassador's daughter was named Margarita Henkel, so he made the drink for her and named it after her. So just happenstance, I mean, I guess in that thought, it's like, oh, well, your name is Margarita. Margarita means Daisy. I'm going to base a drink off the Daisy style. So maybe he's trying to say, like, he knew the style existed, but he made the drink based off of it. I don't know. But this is still, like, we're going on, like, 8 years after we first had this drink already in publication.
That's interesting. I'm wondering if, like, because, like, you know, the internet didn't exist, so, like, news doesn't travel fast, but, like, also there's just, like, you know, there's like a lot of things happening in culture and in the world that are going to influence people no matter what, even if they don't know that they're connected. So it's just like, is it kind of like a seed was planted and then it sprouted in different places for different reasons, but actually for the same reason? Like, it's based off of the daisy.
Right.
But people are like making connections with that in different ways. I'm wondering about that. It's really fascinating to me how information spreads before the internet age.
Well, and I mean, I could understand, because here's the thing, like, I even like today when I'm making drinks at my bar, like a lot of times I'll work off of classic structures. Like, I'll say, okay, here's what's in a Manhattan. I'll split a couple ingredients, exchange things. Now, the thought that whatever formulation I come up with, some other bartender somewhere has it come up with, of course somebody has. Yeah. Like, you know. But I think in this time period, it's a combination of just that, like the obvious, like we understand there's a structure and we all play with it. And then there is no internet, so there is no communication. I mean, there is a publication in, I didn't mention this, but like in 1937, that's from the UK, a bartender's guide that comes out in the UK. And it talks about the picador, but it's the exact same specs as the margarita. So they were making that.
Yeah. But it's also not like people in America were reading publications in the UK. That's the other thing. Like just because, like, oh, this was published, so like we knew about it, not everybody knew about it.
It was a collective unconscious about the margarita needing to exist.
It was really like, that's like a really pivotal moment in history when we were all thinking about this particular drink and we needed it so we could eventually just like sip a blended version of it by the beach.
Well, and like as we move forward, like farther away from these publication dates, like the mid-1930s, stories start to fall apart a bit more just because of how much history of it existing has been out there. Like there's a Pancho Morales who says he made it at Tommy's Bar in Juarez, and that was 1942. There's a whole story behind that, but like it's after so many stories have come. And then, of course, in 1945, you have Jose Cuervo tequila hitting the market. And they have this whole ad campaign, which is, like, margarita's not just a girl's name. Like, so they're advertising the margarita as a thing to do with Jose Cuervo tequila.
Okay.
And they claim the drink was invented in 1938 for a Mexican showgirl named Rita de la Rosa. But that's like a back label story.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, even like all of these, I feel like, in the 40s are kind of called into suspect because you have so much history before that of people making the drink, publishing the recipe, calling it a margarita, even calling it a tequila daisy. I would argue like that's the same drink.
Yeah, for sure.
But some things that we do know for sure are that no one really competes for this claim. Around 1947, the first frozen margaritas were probably made.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How did they do that? They had electricity.
Yeah.
So they had a blender.
They were blending them.
I was like, how did they do that without a blender, with the primitive technology that they had in 1947?
Well, and you don't see like the actual commercial machines until the 70s, but like people were like mixing them with crushed ice in the late 40s, which does completely, I think, shred the next two claims, because now we're in the late 1940s. People are still saying they made the margarita. Like in 1948, there's this Dallas socialite by the name of Margarita Samez who says that she made it in her Acapulco vacation home. And she made it for Tommy Hilton. Of the Hiltons,
yeah. Of course. She had to come up with an original cocktail for Tommy Hilton.
Yeah, and that's why he put it on the menu in all of his hotels. So
maybe he had just never heard of the margarita, and she was like, you're going to love this.
I think that's absolutely true.
I can totally conceive that Tommy Hilton had no idea what a margarita was, and she was like, okay, you gotta drink this drink. It's my namesake.
Like, this is kind of like the Bloody Mary, where a bunch of bartenders spent like a decade figuring it out and getting it out there, and then some socialite comes along and says, like, I made it, ha! It's
I introduced it to a bunch of socialites and celebrities. No.
But even like in then in 1948, we have like another bartender in Texas saying that, oh no, I named it after Peggy Lee. Like, and I made it. Yeah.
Why didn't you call it Peggy Lee then?
Because Peggy is Margaret, and like that's like her real first name. Oh. I don't know. Like,
okay, so, that's a stretch.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like, outside of the original assumption that David Wondrich made of, I think that people went south of the border during Prohibition and asked for daisies, and a lot of bartenders created something with tequila kind of like a daisy. I don't know if any of these are true.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like the most logical thing.
Yeah. But.
Yeah.
But definitely, without a doubt, Mariano Martinez at his Dallas restaurant in 1971 invented the first commercial margarita machine to produce frozen margaritas. So, and that machine is in the Smithsonian now.
The first margarita machine is in the Smithsonian?
It is.
Well, it's a national treasure.
It is. And I'm glad we can't figure out who to thank for the margarita because there are just so many options.
But the margarita machine,
yes.
Nicolas Cage is after that.
Yes, it's got some sort of map on the back to the Ark of the Covenant. I don't know. That sounds right.
Yeah, of course.
I'd watch that movie.
I would totally watch that movie.
Jimmy Buffett is helping him.
Oh my God, Jimmy Buffett. Okay. Is that a segue?
I think it is.
All right. Well, I'm actually kind of nervous about this because my uncle listens to this podcast and he's a really big Jimmy Buffett fan. So.
Have you met my family?
Well, no, I know them. But like, okay, everyone. I'm nervous about everyone.
Jimmy Buffett might hear this.
Jimmy, if you're listening, I'm not going to say anything bad about you. I like you a lot. But I'm not going to give you the full history of Jimmy Buffett. That would take a long time. That would be a whole, that would be like a four-part podcast. You know, he wrote a book. So, so I'm going to tell you about this origin story of the song Margaritaville. And it goes a little something like this. Jimmy Buffett was actually born in Mississippi and raised in Alabama, and he didn't come to Key West until about 1971, because first he was like spending a lot of time in Nashville. He really wanted to be a songwriter. His family was actually like, the family business was fishing, but he always wanted to be a songwriter. He always wanted to be a musician. So he was spending a lot of time in Nashville because that's where you go if you're trying to write songs in that time, especially if you're of like the country kind of genre. So that's where he met Jerry Jeff Walker. Around like 1971, while recovering from his first flopped album, which was Down to Earth, and Jimmy Buffett also was recently divorced from his first wife, which is kind of really sad because he was 24. Like, to be recently divorced at 24 and, like, have one of your albums flop, like, he wasn't really feeling himself very well. So Jerry Jeff Walker took him to Key West, and that was his introduction to it, and he actually moved there for a while. I mean, he was moving around. He was a musician. But while he was in Nashville, he also met Norbert Putnam, and he had asked Norbert to work on an album with him about the, you know, because he'd been in the Keys and he'd been around, so he was like, I want to write an album about this carefree lifestyle by the water. So, and Putnam was like, okay, well, if you're going to write that, you got to be on the water.
You have to have some, like, experience.
Yeah, you gotta go over there. Yeah, you gotta spend some time there. So so he did. He spent some time in Key West. And the story of Margaritaville is that he had just finished a tour in Texas with the Coral Reefers.
Yeah, the Coral Reefers.
Yeah. And so he spent an afternoon at a Mexican restaurant in Austin having margaritas with a friend. Some of the things that he says kind of makes me think that she was a little bit more than a friend.
Oh.
Because when asked about how the song was conceived, he says, it was written in 5 minutes about a hot day in Austin, Texas with a margarita and a beautiful woman.
Nice.
Right.
I like that.
Yeah, and he also told you know, because he started writing it in Austin, and then and he had to like pretty much go to the airport and then go back to Key West. So he told Rolling Stone, "It was a hot day and I had a couple of margaritas. I was a bit hungover, but I started writing the song on my guitar case at the Austin airport. I wasn't wasting away. I was working my ass off."
And he was like,
"I think this song's pretty good." So he finished it when he landed in Key West at the old Anchor Inn while watching gridlock on the roads. He took it to his producer, Norbert Putnam, and Norbert tells a story about Jimmy told him about a day that he had in Key West, that he was coming home from a bar and that he lost one of his flip-flops and he stepped on a beer can top and he couldn't find the salt for his margarita. And when he told Putnam that he was writing the lyrics for it, Putnam said, "That's a terrible idea for a song." But a few days later, he came back and he played it and everybody knew that it was a hit. And the quote I have from Putnam is, "Hell, it wasn't a song, it was a movie."
Yeah.
Interesting. So the lyric "stepped on a pop top" is comes from that, like, so back then in like the early 70s, soda or beer cans like didn't have like the soda cans that we have today where it like you pop it and it goes in.
Yeah.
It didn't go in, you popped it and it came up. It popped off. Yeah. And so people would just like pop them off and throw them anywhere and people would step on them. And apparently enough people got hurt from that, that in the late 70s, they changed the design.
Oh.
Because a lot of people were stepping on those pop tops. Just a little trivia fact for you there. Yeah. So this song was a success. It was number 8 on the billboards and 14th in the charts for that year. And it's the only Jimmy Buffett song to be in the top 10 on Billboard. Like, he had a lot in the top 40, but it's the only one to get to the top 10, which is like, it's criminal. Funny because it's like, yeah, I mean, he has, the thing is, like, Margaritaville's great, but he has better songs, though.
Great song.
Well, but he has great songs that are like really good songwriting. Like, yeah. Like Margaritaville was great songwriting, and it's the basis for his empire. But like as far as songwriting goes, he has a lot of really good songs that are probably like a little bit better than Margaritaville. But it was like it capitalized on the idea of what people at the time perceived the islands to be, like,
right.
You know, so yeah. And actually, like, I really love this story. I was like, I told you earlier, I was like kind of depressed today because I'm like a little bit of money troubles right now, you know, struggling artist kind of shit. But when I researched this story, I was like, this is really amazing, you know, like it's really, because he was really kind of down on his luck and he was actually, so like in the initial success of the song, he was thrilled because he's like, oh, now I can buy a boat and I can just like, even if I'm a one hit wonder, I'm happy as long as like, I'll just sail around the islands, you know, like I'll just live my life. I got my boat, like, He never imagined
the
crazy success. That is the dream. I mean, I would sell for that. That's like, you know, it's like, it's a great dream. And it's like, it's a pretty modest dream too. But like, he never imagined that it was going to be this successful. And actually, the thing that made it is that Chi-Chi's, you know, that restaurant...
Oh, I know Chi-Chi's.
You know Chi-Chi's?
I have had many a Mexican pizza in Chi-Chi's.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why we always ordered those. That was one of the things we always got.
Really?
Yes.
I don't even I remember going to Chi-Chi's, but I don't remember, like, what was there. It's kind of like Applebee's, I feel like. It's like
it
that
was.
Kind of, or like TGI Fridays, but like a little bit less. It's like, it's not, I don't know. It's not like the goal. If you're like, I'm going to go out on a Saturday night.
It's not the goal.
You're not trying to go to Chi-Chi's. But, okay, so Chi-Chi's had a drink special that they called the Margaritaville. and they tried to trademark it. So Buffett saw that and was like, no. And he
Thank
sued.
You, Jimmy Buffett. That is the correct response.
He's like, no, that's my intellectual property. So he sued. And here's the thing about this lawsuit. So you can't actually trademark a song. So Jimmy Buffett's lawyer argued that even though, like, it's, you know, normally you can't trademark a song, but the name Margaritaville is synonymous with Jimmy Buffett.
And it is.
It is. And so I'm going to tell you some legal jargon right now because I had to, like, I had to break this down. But here's Chi-Chi's argument. So Chi-Chi argued. Chi-Chi.
Chi-Chi themselves? The god Chi-Chi.
So Chi-Chi's argued, if a nexus exists between songs and restaurants, a poser could claim an equal nexus between songs and the tangible items of the universe, which basically means, like, okay, well, if you can say that, then, like, you could claim anything. Like, you could trademark anything if that's true. But actually the... Yeah, it's like saying, like okay, so if you've got salt on your nose and it's adorable.
Oh, no. You're having margaritas.
So
I was nibbling on sponge cake.
No.
Sponge of the sun make.
So if you, like, basically that legal jargon translates to, like, if you if you can trademark a song because you made up a name, then you could do that to anything. Like, you could name that, you could rename this computer Barbara and trademark it. Like, I don't know. It's kind of like that. Like, you could basically do that with anything.
But that's different than, like, I don't think we had the concept of Margaritaville before Jimmy Buffett proposed to us. Well, the concept of a land where you just drank margaritas.
Well, also, Jimmy Buffett says that it's not a place, it's a state of mind.
Even that.
Even further, it's an ideology. So, but, you know, like, you know, if you were the judge, you would have ruled this, and this is what the judge ruled. The court ruled in favor of Jimmy Buffett.
That was a cool judge. Thank you, judge.
Thanks, judge. So that meant that even if they weren't, like, trying to do this, what that in turn meant was that Margaritaville and Jimmy Buffett were now synonymous in the eyes of the law. So, and also, fun thing to add to that is that while this case was ongoing, while the suit was ongoing, Jimmy Buffett branded Margaritaville across as many assets as possible. So he's like,
that's my boy.
Yeah, he's like, I'm gonna take advantage of this, or not even take advantage, I'm gonna, like, you know what, I'm gonna say this is my intellectual property, and while I am making that stance, I'm gonna put my money where my mouth is. I'm gonna put all of this name across everything I own. So actually what came out of that, so now that he secured the trademark, he in effect could take it from copyrighted material to a brand and in turn an empire. So the Jimmy Buffett franchise includes a chain of businesses named after the song, starting in Key West and now, like, ever expanding resorts, casinos, restaurants, an up and coming adult living community. Merchandise, really? From everything from, yeah, I mean, why not?
Oh, no, my parents are going to want to go there.
They're going to want to live there, for sure. Yeah, I mean, why not? Wouldn't you want to go visit, like, your parents?
We want to take
care
of you forever because we love you. And they're going to be like, nah, we're going to Jimmy Buffett's place.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's the move, right? Like, no, this was really, see. Also my, like, a little segue. So I called my uncle before this because I wanted to, he's a lawyer, so, and he listens to the podcast, so I wanted to ask him about the legal jargon and make sure that I understood what it meant. But he said that the winter of 77 and 78, right after the song came out, were, like, really, really bad. So the idea of, like, transporting yourself to this Margaritaville state of mind, yeah, was really attractive to a lot of people. Like, just like taking like a mental break to the tropics. Like, and that's why, you know, like parrot heads actually outnumber deadheads.
Wow.
Crazy, right? So, you know, that capitalized on everything from all of those resorts and casinos and restaurants to beach apparel and home decor and even a trademarked frozen margarita blender. Yeah, so like across all of these businesses, in total, more than 21 million travelers visit a Margaritaville destination every year.
Nice.
Yeah. Also, it's a musical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
It's a musical. Yeah. So, and also in 1998, he launched Radio Margaritaville. Now, this is really interesting because it was kind of, he was kind of like one of the first artists to capitalize on the internet when everybody else was focused on CDs. So, this is like a channel that broadcasts his songs and live shows online, as well as other artists that fall somewhere in his aesthetic, like Bob Marley and the Wailers and like anything that's kind of like island, like maybe, or country themed, just anything that falls in the Jimmy Buffett aesthetic.
I think what you're telling me is he's like crazy smart.
He's super smart. Like, he's one of like the smartest.
Like, for as much as we love his music, like Jimmy Buffett is really smart.
He figured it out. He figured out what to do with it. So when he launched Radio Margaritaville, he was picked up by SiriusXM and Dish Network and then expanded into a digital platform, included mobile games and its own video channel. This has been compared to the Star Wars franchise. That's how big it is. And he really like laid the groundwork for a lot of other artists, a lot of other music artists to focus on branding outside of their music. Like before that, nobody was really doing that. And that's like a great way for artists to monetize on their success is by branching out into things that aren't just their music. I mean, he did create a channel that's like, I mean, it's kind of, when I read this, I was like, it's kind of like he created his own title back in the day. Like, it's really fucking smart. So in 2016, he was ranked number 13 on Forbes' first ever list of America's wealthiest celebrities. And today, at 72, he is worth $600 million. Yeah.
But he's still just such a nice guy.
He is. He's a really down-to-earth guy, and he's really, like, that's, like, part of the things that he says. Like, he's always going to, he loves the kind of culture around Margaritaville because he's, like, very down-to-earth. He's very much, like, into being there for his fans, and, you know, like, if you see him on the street and you say hello, like, he'll say hey. Like, he's not, like, for all that he's worth, he's not like an uppity celebrity. Like, he's very, you wouldn't, I feel like if you didn't look into it or if you didn't really know that much, like, you wouldn't know that Jimmy Buffett is worth that much. But like, because he doesn't act like it.
Jimmy Buffett is priceless.
Okay. I mean,
no, I get what you're saying.
No, yeah, like, he's super down to earth. Yeah. Cool guy, man. And he's fucking smart. Like, he really, I mean, I think it was like the turning point was like that Chi-Chi's lawsuit, when it was like, oh, like, somebody wants to monetize on my thing, I'm going to fight that. And also, good idea, I'm going to monetize on my thing.
That's, I am glad to know that Jimmy Buffett got all he ever wanted and more, because I'm pretty sure he deserves it.
Yeah, I think so.
I hope I'm not wrong.
I think so. I mean, I have no reason to believe otherwise. I'm sure if, like, at some point somebody listens to this podcast and knows something about Jimmy Buffett that we don't know, they're going to tell us. But I haven't found anything problematic about him.
No, Jimmy Buffett
seems like a cool guy.
Yeah.
I mean,
we're even going to cut out the part where we question this just now.
Okay.
I think so.
That's good. Don't question Jimmy Buffett. I mean, I know.
I don't believe in Santa Claus anymore, but I believe in Jimmy Buffett.
And I believe in Jimmy Buffett.
Basically the same thing to me as an adult. going to Jimmy Buffett concerts since I was a child. Like,
oh my god! Like,
no, I mean, like,
I've never been to a Jimmy Buffett concert. I can't. I was surprised that you let me do this part. I thought that you'd really want to do it.
Well, I didn't. I mean, it just, you know, we were like, well, I knew the cocktail history, and like, you're gonna do the, like, you know, you, that was like the story. But you did a great job.
Aw, thanks.
But no, like, I think you know you get it right, because like, that's the thing, like, going to Jimmy Buffett concerts since I was a kid, it's like, there's like a newer contingent, like a younger contingent, younger than me. And I think there will always be one that's like, oh, it's cool. It's a place you show up and it's the songs are about drinking. And those people like fade out and fade in. And that's always going to be a thing. But ultimately, there's still like a base camp of people that are like, nope, this is about relaxing and not minding too much. And like, you know, it's just like, it's very, there's like kind of a, like a deviant wholesome.
Yeah, it's very much about escapism, I think, but not in a unhealthy way. It's like, we worked really hard and now we're going to take a little time off to not worry about stuff.
Yeah. Oh, I don't want to wax poetic about Jimmy Buffett.
We can totally wax poetic about Jimmy Buffett. Well, I feel like people would be into it.
But he definitely takes stances. He takes stances like heavily about environmentalism. And I think even that, it's like, he's got such an approachable package that like, he can kind of slip in ideas that I think are important, even if it's just like popularizing the idea of like, relaxation is okay. Like, it runs counterculture only because that's so like, that's counterculture, which is so crazy.
yeah, for sure. I mean, at the beginning of his career, they kind of like, they didn't really categorize him as country. It was more like in the folk camp. So that totally makes sense with like taking a stand and writing songs about that. What's your favorite Jimmy Buffett song?
My favorite Jimmy Buffett song is actually the song that my dad dedicated to me when I was a kid. And it's Delaney Talks to Statues. It's about one of his daughters, one of Jimmy Buffett's daughters.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it's really sweet.
Aww. So
that's the song that always makes me cry.
Oh, I want to cry now.
Do you have a favorite Jimmy Buffett song?
I like Fins. I think it's fun.
Fins is great. Fins is great because it's also, it gives you dance moves and it tells you how to do them.
Yeah, I love dance that. Moves. I love that. All I want from a song is to tell me how to dance.
Right? It's got excitement, it's got intrigue, it's got sharks. It's great.
It's got sharks, yes.
Great song.
I had a dream about sharks.
Oh no, after researching?
No, just like this week, randomly. It was like there was massive flooding in the city, but like the problem wasn't like the normal things that come with flooding. The problem was like now there were sharks around.
That's not a thing we should worry about.
But there was a great white shark spotted in New York City. Not on in the street.
Walking down Fifth Avenue on a little briefcase and a little suit jacket.
On the beach.
I'm gonna visit a top priority.
Isn't that like a thing on Wall Street? Sharks?
Sharks?
Don't they call that like somebody who's like into business real hardcore and will like come after you and shit, like say like,
I don't know, like a loan shark or like a pool shark. I don't know about a Wall Street shark.
I feel like that's a term in business.
I think they're all just assholes.
What about Shark Tank?
Okay, we're going way out.
Okay, let's do our sign off.
All right, well, thank you so much for researching my hero Jimmy Buffett.
Anytime. Also, thank you to Absurdist for our theme music. We freaking love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, thank you to everyone who has helped us out on Patreon so far. We really, really appreciate you. And if you want to check out our Patreon, it's up now. We'll put the link in our show notes, as well as the link to our video companion to this.
And in fact, if you have donated to our Patreon, we'll be getting in contact with you individually soon, but we want to let you know that we will be accepting your questions about liquor history, And answering them on the podcast. And who knows, if there's enough content, then we'll make them into a whole episode. So if you want to be a Patreon donor, you can have a personalized episode. So help us out.
Possibly. Mm. We'll look at that soon. Yeah, but thank you so much for listening. This has been really fun making this so far, and I really am excited for it to keep going. We got a Patreon. Hey, man. This has been
Neat. I am Taylor Smurl.
I'm Liz June.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Go drink a margarita.
Drink some margaritavilles.
I don't think Chi-Chi exists anymore.
It does. Well, is it out of business? It might be out of business now.
I don't know. Jimmy Buffett is definitely still in business.
For sure.